Welcome to Masters of the Stage, an SDC Foundation podcast. I'm Ethan McSweeney, a proud trustee of the SDC Foundation and your host today for the second of an ongoing series of podcasts focusing on directors and choreographers who have carved out careers in the classical theater in America and beyond. I'm here today with Eric Tucker, artistic director of the Bedlam Theater Company in New York City and one of the most exciting classical interpreters working in the theater today. Eric and Bedlam burst to prominence with a tiny cast, St. Joan, in 2014, garnering critical acclaim and industry attention and earning Eric Wall Street Journal Director of the Year accolades, among others. Eric and Bedlam went on to take that actor-driven model of storytelling to other classic tales, including Sense and Sensibility, which was nominated for a brace of Helen Hayes Awards and garnered Eric a Best Director, Vanity Fair, Peter Pan, Pygmalion, a wonderful mashup, Uncle Romeo, Vanya, Juliet, which is exactly what it sounds like, and basically a decade's worth of top 10 critics' pick lists. But Eric has also maintained an active freelance career, directing at Bristol Riverside, Two River, American Players, Hudson Valley, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and now the American Shakespeare Center, where his freewheeling and wildly imaginative production of George Bernard Shaw's Caesar and Cleopatra will join our Roman repertory season in August, completing a triptych of Shaw and Shakespeare that follows Caesar and Cleopatra with Julius Caesar and finishes with Antony and Cleopatra, a trio that to our knowledge has never been produced in repertory by a single company. I'm hoping we will in the course of this conversation talk a little bit more about that show and Eric's impressions of what it is like to work within the Shakespearean performance condition parameters of ASC's iconic Blackfriars stage and what a test that is of a director's mettle. But first, welcome Eric.
Thank you.
Is it Bedlam Theater Company or just Bedlam?
Bedlam.
No theater company.
No.
It's just Bedlam.
Yeah.
What's the founding myth of Bedlam? How did you start Bedlam?
Well.
Why?
Yeah, well, that's it. Why? Why would anyone start a theater company in New York City?
I mean, it's really a perverse thing to do.
Yeah. Well, actually, I started it with a partner who, a woman named Andris Nichols. We started the company together. And we were doing that thing with a couple of friends of ours where you make lists of names. What are we going to call the theater company? You know, have all these, everything from the absurd to obscene to, you know, to very, you know, very full of himself kind of names. And like, oh, we don't want to take ourselves too seriously, but it needs to roll off the tongue. And she actually called me one day. She said, I saw a sign. It says Bedlam. I think that's an amazing name. And I said, I love that. That's kind of perfect. And then she said, oh, no, wait, it doesn't say Bedlam. It says Red Farm. And I said, okay. I didn't think she had her glasses on.
Wow.
And I said, well, Bedlam's still a really cool name. Let's use it. And you know, not we knew later, we thought, oh, yeah, that's also the name of the insane asylum that they would call Bedlam, you know, right, in London. And, and people would watch through the gates for entertainment, watch all the
Yeah, I mean, well, before Netflix,
right?
What else were you going to do?
Yeah, so you know, that's how we got the name.
It is a spectacularly good name on so many levels,
and when and you're at the top of the alphabet, so for Mark,
even that, I mean, and when you think you could have been called Red Farm,
there's a joke in there, though, right? Somewhere. Like we say, oh, it's Red Farm. Well, okay, that'll do.
That'll do. but so what moved you aside from, okay, so you came up with a name. I mean, I guess that's the right way. You come up with a name first and then you build a theater company. Did you know it was something that was, I mean, there does seem to be emerging a Bedlam brand.
Yeah.
Was that something you were conscious of when you were starting? Was that an exigency of we can only afford so many people? I mean, how did those come together for you?
No, you know what it is? I think it, I mean, it wasn't, that wasn't foremost on my mind, the brand, or I knew, I always felt like anywhere that I lived, I wanted a company. And so when I was in Providence, Rhode Island, I had my own, even if when I was working at Trinity, I had a company, or when I lived in LA, I had a company. And I just, I always wanted to have a place where I could just do my thing and have a little laboratory and be completely responsible for the work.
Right.
And so in New York, it was no different. I just wanted to strike at the right time and know that I had just enough money, at least, to not have to do showcases, but to be able to do off-Broadway contracts and really run a show, if it could run, if the reviews were there, whatever. So I waited for the right time and the right people to do it with. But otherwise, I think because I started out full on just as an actor, my MFA is as an actor, I always thought of myself as an actor, and directing was secondary. It was, well, I want to do this play, I'm going to do it, produce it, direct it, be in it with some friends, that old thing. And I just did that a lot,
right,
with no money.
Right.
And so my aesthetic, part of that is a Trinity repertory thing. There is an aesthetic there of sort of actor-audience relationship at the core, as minimal as you know, only use what you need kind of a thing going on there as well, which is what I studied under. But I always, that was a thing that turned me on as a director anyway, or as an audience member. And so you add all those elements up, and that was sort of the creation of me, I think. And so when I direct, that's what I tend to do until I come here and add water ballets in. But, you know.
Well, I mean, it is the first water ballet ever on the Black Friar stage. But I do, again, you know, one feels like Inigo Jones would have been so proud.
Right. Yeah.
And we'll talk a little more about it, lest anyone get the sense that actually there is a floating element to your Caesar and Cleopatra. It's an incredibly imaginative piece. What would you say to someone who is thinking about forming a theater company in anywhere, but in New York or Los Angeles, both of which you've lived and worked in? I mean, are there conditions? You said you waited until the conditions sort of felt right to you. Are there ones that you would say, okay, watch these trends or this condition first?
Well, for me, one of those was having a couple donors in place that I knew would support that kind of endeavor. And the other was having the right partnership, because it's like a marriage. You know, you really, you need, a lot of actor friends will say, let's form a theater company, you know, and you know, they don't really know what that means.
Yeah.
They're going to clean the toilets and sell the tickets and get the wine to sell, you know, it's everything, right? And so when you find that person, that knows, it's a lot of hats, not glamorous work. That, for me, those were the big important things to have in place. But I really would say also, I feel like there are, at least in New York, there are so many companies that you have to have some sort of a voice, I think. I mean, how are you different than many others? And I'm not saying that's really the only requisite, or that's all important, but I think it helps if you're going to be noticed that, and especially with classic work. Oh, you're going to do Long Day's Journey Tonight, or you're going to do Shakespeare, or you're going to do, why are you going to do, add to the pile of those that have already been done? Other than, okay, you're a group of actors and you want to do it. I get that. But at the same time, I guess this is where I turn into a director. For me, I discovered as I directed myself as an actor that, oh, wait, I like a certain thing. I mm-hmm. have a sense of what I like. It's just innate. It's in me. And, oh, I guess I'm really a director. Or at least that took the forefront of my, you know.
That's a great segue to something I really wanted to ask you, which is, when did you start to identify yourself as a director?
It's interesting, because I think it happened when that was sort of paying the rent and acting wasn't, that I would do a show and people would see it and people might like it, and so someone else would offer me work at their theater. And mm-hmm. I mean, it was so gradual, because it wasn't my focus. I never assisted. And I wish I had. I wish I had. If I could do it all over again, I'd like to go back and do that phase where I get to see all kinds of other processes. Now, of course, as an actor, I'm watching other directors.
Right.
It's not quite the same, and I see what they're doing, and I would have an opinion about it. But I'm pretty good at staying in my own lane.
Yeah.
I don't. Because part of what I enjoy about acting
when I get to do it all by itself is I like someone else having to worry about the big picture. I love that. I crave it now.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a problem. But it sort of just took over because it started supporting me.
And do you still act and not direct?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
When it's offered to me.
Yeah, that's good.
Hint, hint.
Well, I mean, this is, here we are doing a podcast for directors and choreographers. So
right.
Can I just
say, there you go.
For the record, I think you're a tremendously good actor.
Oh, well, thanks.
I really do. And I'm not just saying that. I really enjoy that aspect so much of your work as a director. Actually getting to see you act in it is really a great pleasure. In that.
Well, thanks. I think that I'm not in a demographic that's maybe highly sought after. But I think that I'm just a better actor when I'm with some other director.
Yeah.
Because it takes a back seat when you're directing. You learn your lines later. I do. I learn my lines later. I you know, you can't really take the director hat off until at least you're through many previews.
Right.
And then you start developing something. It's late in the game. I'd like to be able to, you know, so it's hard.
Well, I mean, I've always felt that great actors often can make really great mm-hmm. directors if they can sort of switch their perspective enough. And I think was a traditional way into the directing arena and remains a really, really valid one, albeit now there's so many more people who are choosing to specialize earlier. But what's it like to, one thing I really can't imagine because I've never been an actor.
Yeah.
Is what it's like to try and switch back and forth when you are directing a show in which you are acting, and let me say, not playing a small part, which usually you don't cast yourself as the ghost of Hamlet's father. You know what I mean? You're you're really going for it. Playing
Henry Higgins.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking of. Was
or like, Hamlet.
I mean, or Hamlet. Literally, right.
Well, that's the hardest one. That's the hardest one. Yeah. I think that's the hardest one, because I did it, because even if you're not directing, you're playing Hamlet, you're probably obsessed with, they've all seen the 10 other Hamlets they love, and Burton, and this, and that, and it's like, you know, so no matter what, you're plagued. Yeah. It's especially hard if then you're directing, but maybe it takes some of the focus off. It's hard, it's just... I think when you're young and brash and you don't think about it, you're like, I can do this. I'm going to play Benedict and direct Much Ado. And it's only as you get older, as I get older, I don't enjoy it as much because I'm just harder on myself and see that it would be better if I wasn't in it or if someone else was directing sometimes.
Do you have someone else you trust to step outside and watch when you're inside it?
Yeah. I mean, for me, that becomes about getting the right assistant director who clearly is going to be all eyes in previews when you're on stage. And I usually get an assistant director in at least, I mean, I only really do this for Bedlam.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to hire me to do that, or they never do, they never have. But someone who, so in tech especially, I can throw them in. Or even if I'm staging something and really want to move people around, they'll jump in and I can, and we trade off. And then even the cast that I use, if they're people I've worked with a lot, I trust their opinions. And they'll say, well, like, I'm not getting this from you, or what if you tried this, or... And there's a kind of free-for-all.
Right.
Although a lot of... And that's some people. Not everybody can let go of you as director enough to be able to have an opinion, even if they do. But I definitely try to bring in a lot of people to watch.
Well, it's interesting because that quality of role switching and shifting also seems to be something that's a hallmark both of Bedlam and of Eric Tucker is the finesse that you require...
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, particularly when it comes to, I mean, here at ASC, you're doing what amounts for you to a large cast production because there's 14 actors in it, even though everyone's having to play at least two parts if they're not Caesar and Cleopatra. But, you know, somehow you managed an utterly convincing and thrilling Pygmalion with six?
Yeah.
Right?
Six.
And obviously a St. Joan with...
Four.
How many were in Sense and Sensibility?
Ten.
Ten, yeah.
Yeah, there were 10, but that when we did that one, we doubled it with Seagull, and I didn't want to double anyone in Seagull. I wanted that to be the 10 I needed for each role, so that made sense for the other one. And people still had to double roles in Sense and Sensibility, but, you know, at first that was an economic thing. It really was economical. Like, I'm doing a small budget show, putting my friends together and producing a show, and these six people will do, and that's how many I can pay. Or it's, you know, it's like getting the band together, so everybody's schedules are crazy,
right.
So you try to use as few people as possible. And then I also think there's something to, well, we're all going to do this show, and it rests on everybody's shoulders. If you're doing a four-person Hamlet, actually, he becomes the smallest role. I mean, he becomes the load that's easier than, because everybody else, the other three, are doing everything else.
Right.
So it's an ensemble piece suddenly, in a way that it might not normally feel. And so you can suddenly, I mean, for me, I have this problem, you know, with a lot of Shakespeare. What's hard about it when we're casting it, you know, I've done Shakespeare's with 45 people, but not the guy with 10 lines isn't going to have the kind of skill or experience than the guy playing Antony or Cleopatra or whoever. So there's that unevenness sometimes in a, I see that a lot in King Lear's, and, you know, where, so sometimes having a small cast is nice because you can get a bunch of quality people and give them more to do. But on the other end, I think the audience has to hear it differently. They listen to it differently. Inevitably, it's, you know, every critic who's ever written about, or at least every show I've done with a reduced cast, some critic's going to say, well, it's helpful if you know it to follow it. But, because, of course, yes, of course it is.
Right.
But I also know it's, for a lot of people, it's probably helpful if they were watching it with a full cast. You know, it's, we make it as clear as we can, and, you know.
Yeah, except that I think that a smaller cast tends to, it emphasizes ensemble, as you've suggested.
Yeah.
It certainly puts a premium on the ability to quickly transform from one character to another, which is just very theatrical.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of embrace of theatricality in that I think makes it more enjoyable sometimes as a piece of theater. Because if you really want to see the 600 character version, then you could watch the movie. You know what I mean? Where that's liable to work. And I agree with you that, you know, it's never the leads that sink you in a Shakespeare play. It's some messenger coming in from out of the blue, and you'd be surprised at how much damage to the ephemeral nature of the suspension of disbelief that you've so carefully created, one person not being able to meet that threshold of excellence can really puncture it.
Totally. Yeah. And I think it goes the same with sets and costumes and props, that if you're doing something low budget, I'd rather not see you try to achieve a thing visually that you couldn't quite achieve. I'd rather just get rid of it and let the audience imagine it somehow. So in a less is more kind of way, it's those elements. It's the thing you just said. It's whatever breaks that really fragile bubble of believability.
Right.
It's so easy to do. It's so easy to break that. And it's I think it's worthwhile cause to try to preserve it.
You did a thing on Pygmalion at the opening that I thought was really brilliant, where you just had us all milling about.
Mm, yeah.
And we as audience, we all became implicated in standing sort of close together underneath the awning of the theater that they've just left, or wherever it is.
They're standing under an awning like at a church.
Right. And so, you know, we were all there, and it happened right in the midst of us. And then we eventually, after that scene, went in and sat down in a very Spartan, in the round.
Yeah.
Setting, which also really worked wonders, I thought, for just letting me listen to the play and not get overwhelmed by the stage effects.
I thought, you know, along the lines of these small cast things, I've done it so much that I've made it a goal to try to invent new rules each time, or say, okay, we're going to do Pygmalion, and there's this one scene where four of you have to be, I don't know, eight people or whatever it is. And we're going to do hats and stuff. And we've done that, and I did that in a 12th night where we're like throwing hats back and forth to try to be all the characters at the end, and made it a kind of a show-stopping number kind of a thing. And it's like, if it feels right for the moment, fine. But otherwise, it's challenging, I think, each time to try to invent new rules. Okay, are we going to share characters in this one, or is that not allowed? Do we have to find a new way of changing that perspective? Or it can't be with a prop. It has to be this. Mm-hmm. Or whatever that is, a myriad of ways. And I think with Pygmalion, it became about, I thought, well, there's six of us. We have to make a street scene, a crowd scene. And we could do that in... We could think of clever ways to do that, of course. But why don't we just let the audience be the street scene and not do a clever thing? Because it gets old. I get tired of making those kinds of clever, you know,
right.
when maybe we're going to have to do that later in the play.
Right.
Let's just do the first scene outside of the space. And it just takes care of it.
Right. So it was a solution to the problem
yes.
that the play presented.
Yeah, with six people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, just segueing from that to Caesar and Cleopatra, mm-hmm. and you know, one of the things with Shaw is that the stage directions themselves are so elaborate.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that it's a bit of a trick that he's done, because he didn't really write them for the stage interpreter. He wrote them for the literary reader them, and they could, you know, and you can drive yourself nuts trying to reproduce the glint of the moonlight on the sands of the paws of the Sphinx.
Right.
And you have found a way in Caesar and Cleopatra to simplify it and mm-hmm. yet get us from one place to another with a great deal of beauty and efficiency. What made you create a water ballet at the end of our part one?
I think there was something about, you know, having to figure out, well, how are we going to do this dive? They dive off into the water, and then one person...
And they have lines still.
They have lines. I mean... They're swimming. And one person has dived into the water and is still in the scene having to talk to the other person.
Yeah.
And sure, we could throw him off stage, and then we hear a voice. You know, there's all kinds of sort of more old-fashioned stage tricks to do. And I just try to always make it as theatrical as possible, and also try to push the limits of what we think the audience can carry themselves. And I think leaving them on stage and letting the actors, building a moment where they're creating it as if they're telling a story to 10-year-olds, and they got to do it.
Right.
And yet they have nothing, there's no lighting effects, there's no sound effects other than what we can make. And then they're all in the water, and the scene ends. So the boat reached them, but we're not going to black out.
Right.
I could have them swim away, swim off stage. But so suddenly it just felt like in that moment, okay, wait, how are we exiting out of this? Oh, we just need a number. We'll get off stage with a number. And even though that's more complicated, it still is theatrical enough that I think you just push it to another place in order to solve the problem of, well, where do we go from here? How is this a fun ending of Act One?
Right.
And the ending of the play is also a bit like, okay, hail Caesar, and he leaves, and everybody
right.
sort of. So it's not inherently, I don't know, theatrical the way it is, or it is if you figure it out.
Right.
But the water ballet just came in the moment to me. I just thought, this is like a Coen Brothers film or something, you know. I thought of things floating through the water, and because we have Chris, who's so amazing, I just walked over and said, well, what if we did a kind of an underwater sequence, and we need some kind of music here, and we need and he, you know, we're sort of riffing, and he says, oh, it's this high-pitched thing, and he said, he just starts talking about it.
So if you could picture it, so although they're standing on the stage, first a character named
Apollodorus
jumps into the water
yeah.
and swims and talks. Then Caesar follows. Rufio pushes Cleopatra into the water. Then Rufio follows. And at that point, the rest of the company winds up on stage largely playing musical instruments, including Sylvie, who's playing a mandolin wearing a mermaid costume.
Yes.
John is playing the bass. Chris is playing guitar. Someone else is doing percussion.
Yeah.
And in the course of the swimming, the joyous swimming, which is a very freeing moment for the characters, it actually becomes the thing where, like, Caesar is, I think, at his most alive in that moment. But eventually, there's like a crab crawling on the floor.
Yeah.
A cat.
Swimming cat.
Yeah. Wearing water wings.
Yeah.
And someone in a snorkel mask carrying a cutout of a boat. So, yeah. I mean, it goes.
Yeah. And a floating sphinx.
Of course. Well, I mean, that's in the text.
Yeah, the sphinx is that's in the text. Come on.
So did it just start? Is it like once you did one, why not do this? Was that ensemble driven? Was there somebody who said, I could, you know, I've always wanted to play a crab? I mean, how did you?
It was. I mean, I think I just, my image was these guys are swimming and then there's going to be stuff from Act One floating through and people will have to take a thing and endow it with that. And as I just sort of told them the vision of it, and you have a group of people who are willing to play, you know, Leighton grabbed some office supply little clip-on lights and stuck them on her head, and she had little bug, kind of crab-like tentacles, and then Sylvie just laid down on the floor and started, as she's playing the mandolin, she's sort of swimming backwards on the floor. So they just made stuff up, and I think, you know, you just filter and add to, and then we bring in Nancy and get some timing to it and more, you know, you add a dancer, you know, that eye on it. And do we just keep building it to, you know, I think you figure out, well, is this worth it? Are we going to put the time in? I think this could work. Okay, let's do it.
Well, it's a wonderful example of what's possible when you allow your imagination the freedom to keep layering it and you just keep trying to solve a problem. Because I think the big problem you solve is giving the end of part one of a four-act play a big finish, which is something that Shaw didn't have to consider anyway.
Right.
And actually, you're right. He wrote these sort of ring down the curtain kind of hold in place and the curtain drops end of acts that are never Shaw at his best in a way.
So,
We talked a little bit about, you mentioned a little bit your time at the Brown Trinity program. Can you talk about that a little bit more? You obviously went there as an actor.
I did, yeah.
And were there influences in your training there that you continue to draw on as a director, or as an actor?
Yes. When I went there, there was almost no director program to speak of. It was really primarily an acting program, and as actors, we had a playwriting class that we would go to a couple times a week, and we had a directing class a couple times a week that at the time, you know, Oscar Eustace was running Trinity, and he would come teach, you know, maybe once every other week or something like that, and then we had another directing teacher.
Who's that? Oscar Eustace.
Yeah, he's nobody. Nobody influential at all.
Yeah.
And then we had another guy who was a fantastic actor and just a brilliant, brilliant director named Ed Shea, who was a Trinity actor, who was sort of our primary directing teacher. And I learned a lot from him just because he had a really clear, very strong aesthetic of his own. That was based in that sort of Richard Jenkins, you know, who ran the place prior to Oscar, who was a genius director. So rooted in that sort of, you know, Adrian Hall. You know, I mean, Jenkins came out of Adrian Hall, but then Ed Shea. So this stuff gets passed down.
I once assisted Adrian.
Really?
Yeah.
Quite a character. I learned from that, but I think it was more of a company aesthetic that as an actor, you're watching when the work was really on, when it was really working in the way that they could make a play work and sing with an audience to an audience. And so I learned from that. But, you know, I think I don't know. I feel like most people who direct, who have a real aesthetic of their own or a real voice, there's something you always had. It's taste, right? It's just a thing that turns you on about it. And then it sort of, it grows. And I definitely learned a lot as an actor at Trinity Rep about directing.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So.
Right.
And I think you, as an actor, because you're working with so many different directors, like I said, I didn't assist, but I'm still in those processes and able to sort of pick and choose the things that I felt were working, or that I, you know, in terms of storytelling and things like that. So, and how to talk to actors and how to straddle that line of, well, I've got to sometimes be acting coach and this and that, and talk to an actor and talk through this, but then also have a visual eye. And those things aren't always in one director.
No.
But it's nice if you can. So acting helps because you, being on the other side of that, I guess, in a way, certainly gives you a perspective about auditioning and stuff.
Are there directors you've admired that you've worked with?
Yeah, many. I mean, I went to school with, certainly Oscar. I would have to throw in there because, you know, he himself is a brilliant dramaturg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, understands a script so well, and the kinds of experience he has putting together a script and helping a playwright through that, you know, build their play is worthwhile stuff.
Right.
And
right.
then, you know, I went to school with, interesting, I was actually in Liesl Tommy's class. Liesl, you know,
oh,
who directs.
Yeah, of course.
Of course, we were both actors.
But she wasn't
then.
A director either.
No,
yeah,
no.
Wow, what an interesting interesting occurrence
right.
that
so
is.
So we
yeah.
both directed in that program, and we both enjoyed it in the same way.
Yeah.
And so I was never surprised that she also became a director. And then also a year ahead of me was Amanda Daynard, who's a fantastic director, and I was directed by her a lot. And we shared the same taste, the same aesthetic, and really fed off of each other. So she's someone that I really loved working
yeah.
with as an actor purely. And, you know, because I don't know, someone like that, it's like when you're with those people, you as an actor, you just feel so safe and secure in the room with them because you trust that they're going to take you. Yes, I'll just do what, yes, I'll try that, sure, because I trust you're going to. You know, if it's
right.
great, you'll keep it.
It's just interesting that there were so many kind of theater makers coming through the Brown Trinity program at that time, which I think is still sort of something that the program has as an identity.
Yeah.
But, you
I
know, that
so.
Identity might have even been partly shaped by the presence of who was there, by Oscar, by the kind of people that were attracted to
yeah.
Providence, to
yeah.
a company of actors working in concert on classic material. I
yep.
mean, there's something very Edenic about some of that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until you, of course, realize that you're still in Providence, but then, you know.
Yeah.
I love Providence, I guess.
Yeah. But yeah.
What when you finished at Trinity, did you go to New York, Los Angeles?
I went to New York, then Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I went to New York for a couple of years, and then I thought I wanted at least, the one great thing about being at Trinity was that I got to act a lot
mm-hmm.
in Trinity plays, main stage shows.
Yeah.
So I got I was Equity by the time I left. I had a ton of experience. You know, I mean, I got to play Iago there. I did great, some really
yeah.
great roles. And in plays where you're doing long runs, because they have a huge school program, so you're doing a lot of those kinds of performances, you know. I mean, and so enough of that I sort of became disillusioned with it, with acting for a live audience. I just thought, I don't know if that's what I want to do. And the little experience I had doing on-camera work, I thought, this is so much more satisfying because you get a bunch of takes, and then you can be done with it.
Right.
And there are just a few people standing around who, you know, whether they laugh or don't or this or that, none of that matters. And there was something, I don't know, it was refreshing to me. So I went to LA to not do theater, to try to see what that film TV thing was like. And that's where I started directing more and more and
wow.
more theater, which
yeah.
is which isn't what I went out there for.
Right.
And that's where that started to became more of the thing. And so then after being there 6 years, I thought it never felt quite like home the way New York City did. And so I thought, well, that's really where I'm, you know, getting work. I'm doing theater, I'm directing theater. I'm going to go back to New York. And L.A. was sort of, you know, it's a nice, I like L.A. a lot, but it wasn't, then I started missing a place where I wasn't surrounded by actors or people trying to get into the biz
right.
in a way that, you know, wanted
to
escape
from. Did any
that.
Of that have something to do with what it's like to be primarily focused on theater when you're in the Los Angeles television and film matrix? Because
yeah.
I've always thought that that creates an interesting dynamic for people.
Most definitely. And also because while there's a lot of theater, it will always take a back seat.
Of course.
To film and TV and
yeah.
even commercials.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, and if you book a job, you got to leave that play. I mean,
absolutely.
That's
and if you're directing something and you're constantly worried about somebody dropping,
right.
well, I can't make this preview because I booked this commercial and it's shooting two nights in the desert or whatever, you lose them.
Right. So was that, did you have a theater company in Los Angeles?
I did.
What was it called?
It was called Big Head.
Big Head. Big Head.
Yeah.
Still with the B's.
It was still with the B's, which is coincidence. It was
and
named
the
after,
two syllables.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And it was yeah. named after a cat.
Nice.
But it was one of my cats. I had a couple cats. Anyway, one was called Big Head. And I'm like, that's the name of the theater. And
it's the name of your first theater company. But
right.
that also sounds like, you know, it's like the name of your first band. And then like,
yes.
and then we got together and
yeah.
we came up with Red Farm,
right.
you know, or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So Big Head.
Yeah.
So you actually had, I mean, you had an experience of starting a theater company at that stage as well.
Oh, yeah.
Before you sort of put together the Bedlam
yeah.
piece. I mean, that's
yeah.
it. I mean, I think that's quite significant that
yeah.
that's not, you have to build your experience at something. And then the second time having had that, having the wisdom to say, you know what, we need to know, I've got to have at least a few funders in place. Did you immediately launch Bedlam as a not-for-profit? I mean, were you like
yeah.
501c3 from the beginning? Or,
well, or? We were umbrella. We did an umbrella thing under of another company
uh-huh.
that does that. What's the name of that company? We umbrellaed under Fractured Atlas, which is a company in New York City that is its own non-for-profit, and then you can...
Oh.
While you're getting your own 501c3. So,
oh, wow.
So we did the thing where we waited until we could just pay for it. And here's
right.
a few grand to a company that does a, will do all your paperwork.
Right.
Because it's a lot of paperwork.
Time.
And then we were our own 501c3. But even in LA, I had one donor. The only reason I did that was, again, I was out there for another reason, but a friend of a friend said, oh, he directs, and there happened to be a guy out there who's like, I just really want to see good theater. Do you know, I want to, and he had all this money. He was a single guy who had a company where they took high schoolers on tours all over the country,
mm-hmm.
you know, those kinds of things. And he had all this money. He's like, I want to give someone like 50 grand to do a show or two or whatever. And
yeah.
a friend of mine said, you should talk to Eric. And he did, and I was like, all right, well, I'll do something. And then I was sort of doing that, and I'm like, well, gosh, now I have a company in LA, and I'm doing this. And so it was a good lesson in terms of, okay, someone's giving me money, I'm responsible to them in a certain way.
Yeah.
And, you know, you start down that path of
yeah.
being responsible to your donors
yeah.
as an artistic director.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, I mean, and you got a board of directors for
yeah.
Bedlam
yeah.
the works. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of current producing model for Bedlam? Because I think you've done something where you create, that's really not maybe not unique, but I think certainly something that a lot of us aspire to, which is you've created content that then tours in some different ways as well. I mean, and how you're making a show and then trying to keep it in the repertoire is a little bit unusual in terms of it's not just we get together, we do a show, and then the show closes, and the next year we do another show.
Yeah, it's like it was something that there was an opportunity for it because other artistic directors came and said, well, I would love to have that show come to my theater. And I, in spite of other people within my organization who were not really excited about that or didn't see any kind of a payoff for us because we weren't going to make a lot of money at it.
Right.
I was sort of the one person saying, let's just do this. Let's send the show there. I mean, early on, it's great because you want to have
more work, too.
Let's take the show for 8 more weeks here. Why not go to the Only and do St. Joan and Hamlet?
Great.
And, you know, that show, those shows for us who were in the original cast were like 2 years of work. And now, and they're still going this fall with another, like the third cast. So, and it's not easy actually to keep them, it's not easy to keep them in the repertoire because someone drops out, but we've promised it to Alabama Shakespeare. I've got to get another actor up. But, oh, we're only rehearsing a week because we're supposed to know these shows. Well, how's someone going to learn 10 roles in this and 5 in this in a week and a half? They're going to rehearse that? That's a lot. But we have to deliver this show. That's the thing I'm having right now. I'm like paying people in New York to run lines with an actor who's going to go into Hamlet and St. Joan. So it's not easy, even on that level, and then just having... Well, is our lighting designer going with this one? And we have a production manager who now, you know, we did a national tour of Hamlet and Joan, and those went all over. And Sense Sensibility goes, and Sense Sensibility is one where if it goes, I'll still go and direct it.
Right.
And some
with different companies of actors.
Yeah.
Or with a combo.
We'll bring some. Yeah. There was a combination of New York, you know, DC people who have gone to Boston and Portland, and then local Portland people and. So we have a lot of people out there who could do that show if I ever needed, you know, to write 10 people. But it's not easy, but it became worth it because now we've had Bedlam shows all from L.A. to Santa Barbara to Portland to Texas and Houston and everywhere in between, Florida and Alabama Shakes and D.C. and up in Vermont and all over. And we have people who send us money from all those places who have become donors all over. And we've had... You know, when I was in Portland, Marissa Wolf, who took over Portland Center Stage, said, you know, I have people coming up to me saying, we're subscribing to your theater because you're bringing Bedlam here.
Right.
And that's kind of cool. And I'm like, really? How does anyone here know? But it's because I was like, let's just take these shows out and, I don't know, and just do them in places.
Yeah.
And if it gives work to artists, you know, or actors going out, why not?
Are you creating kind of an extended family of Bedlam-enabled actors? I mean, who get the Bedlam storytelling vibe? I mean, is it...
Yeah, a bit. I think so. Because I think as a director, when you work with certain actors over and over, they kind of, you know, there's a shortcut there. Yeah. They just get, oh, he's doing that thing, or she's doing... Yeah. That thing, and that'll pay off here, or that's when we do this. And you, I love that. It's a nice, you don't have to talk so much about certain things or explain yourself. Like, well, this is just a way of doing this, and it works because the, I don't know. So I think so.
It strikes me as a really very modern and contemporary idea of how to have a functioning theater company in the arts, live arts ecosystem of the United States. You know what I mean? Because it's actually really hard. I mean, we have a company here at ASC. We bring people in and out, and we have long runs because we're in repertory.
Yep.
But it's very hard to maintain a company without it becoming something that atrophies a little bit. And yet it's also very difficult to kind of create enough work for everybody to keep them all engaged and happily engaged and even have some... graduation so that you know, if you were this for a while, there's another role for you or something like that. So
I mean, in New York City, we with Bedlam, we only have 3 full-time staff members. And we have a couple part-time, and we do interns and all that. But we certainly, we don't really employ a group of actors all year. But there are some who are employed many, many weeks out of the year if they're doing, say, the new 1 or 2 shows I'm doing, plus they're going on tour in this or going out to this. So we've created a model where, for people who want that, now people have come into the Bedlam world and not wanted to go to do this show out of town or this because they're trying to build a career and they want to be in New York City or be available for pilot season here. Fine. Obviously, a theater company is not for everyone. But if it's for a person, then there's work to be had.
And what... what's upcoming for you? We're sitting here in August. Caesar and Cleopatra opens. Well, I don't want to tell you, but it's the day after tomorrow.
What?
Yes, no, it's the day after tomorrow. Like it or not, it's coming.
Yeah.
And then where do you go from here? You mentioned that it's the same tone in Hamlet.
That's going
that,
right.
That are in Alabama.
Alabama Shakespeare, right. And then they go to Gulf Shore Playhouse in Florida. And the same week those start rehearsal, we start rehearsal in Boston for The Crucible, which will be 13 cast members in Boston and 14 in New York. But 6 of the New York people will be in Boston and go back to New York, so that Boston will have a bunch of locals.
Great.
And then they'll be replaced by New Yorkers fully in New York. But it's the first time we're actually putting a show up in another city first, which is great, and then bringing it to New York. And that's wonderful. So
you're re-pioneering the out-of-town tryout.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, this was the old way.
Yes, and it's kind of gone mostly. It's,
and in a weird way, you were going the opposite direction because you were premiering everything first time in New York and then taking it on the road.
Right. It's easy when you have something that people have loved in New York and gets great reviews for another company to go, well, that worked. Let's bring it here. Sure. But it's helpful to me to be able to...
Is that one you're co-producing?
No. Officially.
No. Okay.
Officially, the Nora, which is part of Central Square Theater in Cambridge, is producing it there. And we're producing it in New York. But it's officially being called in association with, which is really for equity reasons.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. It's just you're still out there making new models for ways to get the work done.
Yeah.
And then when will it open in New York?
It opens November 21st, just before Thanksgiving, but we go into previews a couple weeks before that.
Fantastic.
But we'll have run it for 5 weeks in Boston, which will be great.
Yeah.
So we'll be tweaking and putting in new cast members, but it'll be fun to do.
You're in it.
I am in this one.
Who are you playing?
I'm playing Reverend Hale.
Okay.
Which is a really great role.
Yes.
Is
it one you were dying to play, or is it? I mean, I'm really going to dig in here because I mean, honestly, you don't want to play John Proctor.
I always wanted to play John
Proctor.
You
look like John Proctor.
I always wanted to play John Proctor. I've wanted to do Crucible for years.
Yeah?
I've loved the play for many, many years.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be our third Bedlam show. So after Hamlet Joan, we were going to do The Crucible with Sense and Sensibility.
Oh, of course, because those two things...
Right?
Austin Miller. I mean, there's nothing like
Well, there was something about the community and the way...
collision of that. Yeah.
But we couldn't get the rights.
All right, because of the big Broadway production.
It was coming. Yeah. We didn't know at the time.
Yeah, the first class, the rights were locked up everywhere. Worldwide.
Yes.
I tried to get a production on in Ireland and couldn't.
No.
Yes.
So we couldn't get the rights. I'm like, really? But of course, it was New York. But so then I just thought, well, I can't do Sense. I'm not doing that. But then we did The Seagull. And I thought, well, those still work. And we did it. But I've been waiting and waiting. And I thought, okay, we're going to do it now. And... I always wanted to play that role, but along with, it's a shift in me saying, I'm more interested in this directorially even than playing that role.
Right.
And we did a reading a few months ago, several months back, when I knew we were on track to do it again. And a friend of mine, an actor named Ryan Quinn, an African-American actor, played Proctor. He's perfect for the role. He's a great actor. And I thought, well, I'm going to read Hale in this reading. And reading the role, I realized the arc of this guy is incredible. It's incredible. And, you know, it's where he starts and where he ends up. It's so, so compelling.
And I wonder if there's something about Hale that it more accurately situates you in the role of the director.
Oh, that's interesting, right?
Yes. Because Proctor is acted upon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And rather than and is the receiver of all this stuff rather than the person who's sort of guiding the
which is
ship.
Hale.
Yeah.
You know, he comes in there and he's so looking for the thing and he's really pushing that. He's really pushing the stone along. And of course that's what he ends up regretting. I mean, that he's been kind of the architect of this, you know what I mean? He's been the engine of this thing that's happened. And I mean, Danforth certainly, once those guys come in Act Two and take over,
but he's the guy who brought them in.
He's the guy, yes. Yeah. And there's a lot of shame and a lot of regret in him.
And I think that will be very interesting because I think, you know, of course, if we go see a production that we know Eric Tucker directed and he's in, so we're going to have, we know you're the director, right? Yeah. On some meta level.
Yeah.
I'm semi aware of that even as a general audience member. Yeah. It's not a hidden trait, right? So it's interesting to go, oh, that's where he's sort of put himself, or what the story, the arc is. It strikes me that it's another example, though, of you being remarkably open to something that was not what you expected the decision to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that a modus operandi for you?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I think in all the work we do, it's so easy to cling to an idea or get precious about something, and I think I try not to be precious about anything in a show. You know, when I'm doing a show, I think, oh, that piece works so well, but nope, let's cut it. It's not serving us anymore. And I think that's in the same way. I just thought, I don't need to play that role. And I don't think I'm going to help our play if I'm in that role. And I really wanted to play it opposite my wife. And she is playing Elizabeth.
She's going to play Elizabeth,
But actually, that might not have been a great idea either.
Playing Elizabeth and John Proctor every night may not be the greatest recipe.
Yeah.
The first time I saw your wife on stage was in the Uncle Vanya Romeo. No.
Yep. Uncle Romeo Vanya Julia.
Uncle Romeo Vanya
Julia.
You
know that old chestnut.
That old chestnut.
Yeah.
And she was wonderful. Yeah. That was such, to me, that was such an interesting piece and those mashup. What inspired you to mash those two together?
I was dying to do Uncle Vanya. I love Chekhov, and I that was on my list for a Bedlam show. And then I had an idea, a kind of seed about Romeo and Juliet, and I thought I just saw it in my mind how to do Romeo and Juliet with five or six people, and I thought I really want to do. I started reading it again with that idea, and I thought, oh God, I love this language, and I love the idea of a bunch of broken adults having to say those words. What would that be like?
Then you looked at the Chekhov, and you're like, look, broken adults, here they
are. Well, and then I thought, if we're going to do a rep thing, and then the more I thought about them, there were sections of Romeo and Juliet that I wasn't as interested in. And then all of a sudden I just thought, if there's an outside look, there's a 30,000 feet up view of all this as an artistic director, I think, when you're programming, right? And you think, and for me it was, when I decided we were going to do Hamlet and St. Joan together, that was purely based on, not only is St. Joan one of my favorite plays in the world, Hamlet too, let's face it, it's a good play.
Not bad,
right? Yeah. But I thought, if we're going to start a theater company, we have to do something really hard with a cool idea, four people doing these two plays, and if we could do them good enough that people, well enough that, you know, that maybe they'd sell tickets to each other, but get noticed. Yeah. And I just thought, but then if you do that, my thing is, how do you keep, from a programming standpoint, topping yourself, that you can't then sort of rest on your laurels. You know, Crucible, that's a big play. That's a hard play. I don't know that I've ever loved a production so much. I thought, I don't ever need to do that. Like, I don't need to do Our Town after seeing David Cromer's. I don't ever want to touch it.
Yeah. You know that feeling you get where you're like, absolutely. Why would I do that?
Absolutely.
And I don't feel that way about the Crucible, but
I don't either. I'm dying to see yours.
Well,
like, no, I can't wait. I'm really like so excited because I feel like it's a play that so often the essential truths of it go missing.
Yeah. But I think with the other thing, it was like, I don't know. Suddenly I thought this could be on the same stage, these two plays, this sort of, you know, that if those two people had lived, they could be the professor and Yelena. They could be any other marriage they died when they were teenagers, so we think it's a great love, but
right. Because it never had to stick around.
Or they are the thing, what if? What if I've never had that, I never felt like that. I just thought, but mashing them together was sort of like, I didn't have the key to it, and I still don't. It's one of those things where I'm like, I wish we had, we didn't hit that. But I just thought, that's an idea that you're like, what? How are they going to do that? And even not knowing how to do it, I thought, I know that if we do Pygmalion and we do it simply and we don't really screw it up or do anything weird to it, it could do well. It's going to sell. It's a great play. It's a popular... There's something about it that it could... But for me, doing something that where maybe half the people are going to walk out, it doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we should do it.
Yeah.
We should try to do things that are kind of experimental and odd just because we're not going to just do another Romeo and Juliet or another Vanya. We've all seen those. Right, so let's look at them together. And it's not for everyone.
Right. Right. Because otherwise, how does the Bedlam Vanya look different from Vanya on 42nd Street or something like that, which was really, really good.
Yes.
You know?
Are you kidding? That's one of my favorite things ever was that.
Yeah. And super inspirational.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I just think, how do
my
you...
My feeling is, in a way, that you're not done with this Uncle Romeo, Vanya, Juliet. Thing.
Maybe.
It'll come back around. I mean, I think about how long Bill Rausch worked on his Medea Macbeth Cinderella, and it grew and changed for him as he kept pondering the intersection of those things. And maybe with particularly those two plays, they have a lot to offer kind of continually.
So. Well, I mean, we spent several weeks rehearsing and we, you do that thing where it's like, okay, well, I started day one with my idea of what the script would be. Right. And then in the first week, it was a totally different script.
Right.
And then we think, oh, we have it. Good. Well, now the next 6 weeks, where's it? And then the next week, we have a whole other script. And then, no, it's got to be this.
Yeah.
And the script never stopped changing until opening. And even after opening, because I'm in it, we would say, oh, let's do this. Try these things faster and do this. We would change the script.
Yeah.
And the order of things, because we could when we opened. So we were always... It never settled. So you're right. The problem there is just having the money to say, do I want to go back to that and spend money and do it? But I want to do these new things.
Yeah.
But I would love, are you kidding, to bring back things like that and keep, it always comes down to a financial decision.
Yeah. And repertory was very, I mean, it was also a really important part, I mean, Hamlet and St. Joan and Sense and Sensibility.
Seagull.
Coupled with Seagull. Yeah. I mean, that these
two Twelfth Nights we did,
What were the two Twelfth Nights?
We did two Twelfth Nights in rep that originally I was going to do Twelfth Night and The Country Girl. And we were in rehearsal for Twelfth Night. And the rights fell through for Country Girl. And I was like, shoot, we don't have a second play. What are we going to put with Twelfth Night? We were in Boston performing St. Joan and then in the day rehearsing for our next thing that was going to start in New York. And I just thought, we'll call the other one What You Will. And the idea would be that it's like from another planet, completely different roles. Different cutting and drive ourselves crazy with that. Like, how do we, and just do that. They were super successful for us. We did them in
Boston, and was able to make What You Will even better, mm-hmm. which I felt like we didn't complete it till then. And now we might do them at Folger, and we want to bring them back to New York. Those are a real key. Those were great and fun.
As the duo.
As a duo. So you're seeing Twelfth Night and then What You Will, and they're just very, very different interpretations, very different kind of examinations of gender and how, and perspective and how we doubled and how the double, you know, all that stuff. Very different and fun. And then for me, though, the rep thing is also, the seed of that is as an actor, I think it's so fun to be able to have to play a world one night and completely change it up the next, yeah. and so forth. There's something so just so fun about that as an actor. And even in ways where, say, you take Hamlet and St. Joan, and the idea was that they look almost identical, that you could almost flip a coin each night and say, yeah. whatever we're wearing,
yeah.
props, costumes, set, that we're in the same physical world pretty much, but when you're in those, when you're playing it, they're complete, they're so different. And that the words alone and make the world, is that's an examination of that. And then something like the two Twelfth Nights where, you know, one is like a table and chairs and a guitar and some hats and everybody, and it's like rehearsal memorized.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is like super produced, you know, lights and all in white paint. I mean, you know, like a concept.
Mm-hmm.
Very different worlds, and getting to do each one of those each night, and mm-hmm. yet the same, and different people saying the words, and the relationships are all, that was really fun.
I once did a play, I did the world premiere of it on the West Coast, and then I did the second production of it, the East Coast premiere, and it wasn't that it didn't work on the West Coast, but it didn't work the way we wanted to, and it was a completely different theater, so we had to, and I basically threw out the entire production, and I was like, I want to direct the second production of this as though I were a director who saw my production of the first play and went, yeah. well, don't do that.
Yeah.
And I had even more fun the second time. Like
it's another director.
Like completely doing, I mean, everything. In fact, maybe, you know, going back and doing less of what I thought we were supposed to do and more of what both the writer and I wanted to do the first time,
mm-hmm.
you know, so. Because sometimes you get stuck in those ideas of what you think you are, you ought to be doing with a play.
It's such a gift when you get to do that, my God.
Yeah, it is. Well, I'm envious of even like just blowing out two Twelfth Nights and just being like, we'll do another one, and this one is going to be...
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been deeply difficult to rehearse, especially with different cuttings of the same text, and obviously people playing different roles in each.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it was fun because it started out where... We started rehearsal not knowing who was going to play what in Twelfth Night. I didn't know. And I thought, let's just read it and work through it a bunch for several days, as long as that takes, and do that thing where by the end of several days, it's going to be obvious to everyone who should play what.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done that before, and it works because there's no hard feelings. It's like, oh, I wanted to play that, but she totally is nailing that. That's mm-hmm. speaking to her or him or whatever. So we worked on Twelfth Night for several days, and I said, everybody write down who the casting, and it was universal. I mean, it was just unanimous what that first casting was going to be.
And this was like you reading it kind of round robin style?
Yes, just it was like the table work was just us doing the play and everybody, ooh. You know, each day taking different roles until it was obvious who should play what. And everybody agreed on the casting. There were... five of us in that, and five of us doing both plays. And then what was nice about...
So what was the cast, what were you casting in that
so edition? I was Viola, Sebastian, so I was the twins, and Toby. And in the other one I was Andrew and Orsino. And in the other one, the fun thing, so I was playing the twins, which we did a whole shadow thing at the end, and it was kind of fun, and we just, and then, but the fun thing about the other one was that we had Viola was actually my wife, Susanna was Viola in that one, but when she was in disguise, it was actually another actor who was playing Sebastian. So he was Sebastian and the male
Cesario.
He was Cesario. So essentially
he had a viola and a Cesario.
And they were each other depending on how... So we would have a moment where Orsino's... I'm talking to...
They would both be in there. So if Viola went into soliloquy, she would be Viola.
Sometimes, or we'd have a moment where like... We kept playing with these moments where like I'm talking to him and I might sort of turn and we would all sort of do this bit where then I turn and but I see her and I'm like watching her walk away going but yeah. then it's kind of him and I'm
yeah.
So their male femaleness was based on Orsino's sort of perspective in it,
right?
And then it was so cool because I thought, how do you take two people who aren't twins and tell an audience? Sure, at the beginning you could say these two are twins and we're all going to buy it. And we just do. But could you really make them interchangeable? And the fact that there was a Cesario and a Viola.
Yes.
And then he's yeah. Sebastian.
Yeah.
And then we did this cool trick at the end where that moment, you know, where they speak together, where they're like, mm-hmm. my father had that moment on a mole on his brow. They said those three lines, quick lines at the same time, like jinx. And then when they came out the other end, she was Sebastian lines, he was Viola lines. So we kind of did a switcheroo. When they meet, it's the first time they're actually talking to each other because mm-hmm. they've played the same role, you mm-hmm. know, the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But then they're suddenly meeting and then they speak at the same time in the middle of the scene and come out the other end as different people. And you're like, well, they are interchangeable.
Right.
And by then it was like, and it was, I think we did kind of pull that trick off a little. It was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And so in the end, you know, I end up with him because he's Viola.
Right,
because
they've switched. So
she's Sebastian.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And he's Viola, which works.
So in a way, Viola also stays in the Cesario.
Yeah.
I mean, which is who Orsino fell in love with. Orsino fall in love with Viola or with
right.
Cesario?
Well, that's a fun thing, too. Yeah. And she was dressed... she was very female, her Viola. She had a pencil skirt and a, you know, and because she was also playing Mariah. And really, in that production, the central relationship turned out to be Mariah and Toby, who was a female.
Yeah.
Kelly Curran played Toby in that. And it was beautiful. But it was fun. It's so fun to be able to take them side by side and do all kinds of different things. And if you're an audience seeing both, to dip into them. You have to be a real Shakespeare geek, I think. But why not do stuff for those people?
Well, again, it strikes me that there you are, and it's your openness to the possibility when confronted with the practical reality of losing or not getting the rights to Country Girl. Who knew that would have a rights issue? I mean, and your response is to do something so imminently theatrical.
Yeah.
And that then unlocks this whole other sort of opportunity, which is really magnificent. It's a great metaphor for...
Yeah, there's something about doing these two things in rep with themselves. I mean, a show in rep with itself was another trick. Like, oh, this is a cool thing we have. This is a kind of a...
Yeah, like everyone does rep with two different plays.
Yeah,
nobody reps the same play.
Like what?
Right?
Yeah. And I thought, well, that's how.
Yeah.
So it's a little. No, there was another Odette's that was being done in the city at the same time, and they just didn't want to. The estate did not want to. They're like, we really want you to do Country Girl. Can you just do it later?
Yeah.
We just because they already.
Well, their loss.
Yeah.
Our game.
I love that play.
And you could still do it later.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Well, we were doing it. It was for Andress because she was such perfect. But anyway.
Yeah. I know I was talking to some colleagues at SDCF, and they were familiar with some of your work with veterans, and they said, oh, ask him about what he does with veterans. And is that some work that you started with Bedlam, with Big Head, with Red Farm? With I'm going to keep calling back to Red Farm.
It was with Bedlam. That was the first time I had done that. I mean, you know, a decision had to be made early on about, well, we're going to do some sort of outreach. What will that be? Who are we interested in helping? And, you know, I did actually a pretty quick stint in the Navy. So
I didn't know that.
In the military. So I had that background.
When did you do that?
Right after college.
Yeah.
Right before college. Right before I went to undergrad, I was sort of, I had been living... in Argentina for a few years, and I came back in the fall. I I wasn't going right into school, so I thought, well, I'm gonna. I went into the Navy, and I did.
Didn't know one could really do a quick stint.
Well, you can if. What happened was I came out and I was going to college, and I was doing because I was really thinking I really wanted a career in politics.
Yes.
And you know. Yes. And that sort of thing. So yes. I thought the military is, I had another plan, possibly. Yeah. And then what happened was, so I was going to be month to month, once I was in college, I was going to be doing, you know, reserves.
Stay in the reserves somehow.
You had no choice. I mean, once you're in, they own you for 8 years.
Right. So you joined, you enlisted.
Enlisted, went off to boot camp, then A school, which you do in the Navy, came out of that, went to college, and then... was doing my, I was in Rhode Island, and so I was doing my month-to-month duty in Narragansett, Rhode
right.
Island, on the base.
Right.
And but I was also doing theater. I started doing theater right away, and you know, there were a lot of times I couldn't make that, so I would write a letter and say, oh, it's college-related in theater, and I would always get out of my monthly thing. They always will defer if you're going to college. That was never a problem. But then what happened was, Narragansett base, this was the Clinton years, and they were closing a lot of bases. And so they were closing their Narragansett base, and any of us doing our reserve duty there were going to have to go up state New York, and they were going to have to put us up in hotels. That's an expense. So you were given the choice to have an honorable discharge and just not do it.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, yep, I'm out of here. I did that. I'm not really getting any money for college.
Right.
And I got an honorable discharge because they closed the base.
Wow.
I totally lucked out.
Yeah, you did. That was a serious luck out move.
Yeah, because by then I was like, no, I'm doing theater.
Yeah. A friend of mine is JAG and you know, is served and is it just got recalled and sent away to a year posting in Afghanistan. And he has two young children. And I'm like, I didn't know that could still happen.
Yeah.
But it really can.
Yep.
I mean, it's a real serious commitment.
Yep. I know people who are doing their 15th tour.
Yeah.
It's insane.
So you had a military background, a service background, and that kind of propelled you a little bit towards thinking about veterans as part of the outreach for Bedlam.
So we started a weekly acting class that was free for veterans. And it was an ongoing class, so it never, we did it year round, Monday nights.
In New York?
In New York City. Mm-hmm. And at first it was...
How'd you advertise?
Well, we did it through the VA and veterans programs in mm-hmm. the city, and people started coming out, and it built up to, after a couple of years, there were about 100 and some vets kind of circling in and out of the class. And it was a really great thing because you had people come to the class who are actors, who happen to be vets, and they're getting a free acting class. And then there are vets who are coming because of the community they're getting there.
Sure.
And they just want to be able to, they just want a way to express their emotions, but they don't necessarily want to use their own words.
Right.
And so we primarily started out using Shakespeare and letting them get up and act scenes and act monologues and express and get all this emotion out. But then it just so happens that so many of his characters are veterans or are in the military.
Yeah.
So there's a real connection there.
Was it at first Shakespeare because it's monologues or stuff like that? But I mean, obviously it's not the easiest stuff in the world.
No, but there's something about the language and the verse that they're able to drop into it. Even non-actors are able to drop into that, and it brings up, it just does something to the body
when you
speak that language. And
it's
and then there's a component to the class where they write, and they'll write and have other people act their stuff or that sort of thing. And a lot of great writers come to that group.
I'm fascinated though by the universality, by another discovery about the universality of Shakespeare, that you just we talk about it and sometimes we espouse it, and then you sort of do something with it and you see, my God, but this is yet again true.
that speech that Kate does to Hotspur, mm-hmm. when she comes and she describes him mm-hmm. and what he's like at night when he wakes up, and is the most succinct, amazing description of PTSD. That it's incredible. I mean, there are so many. There's like a vet in every Shakespeare play. There's so, it's incredible.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, PTSD. I think the story of reintegrating people who have been in violent situations in a war mm-hmm. or something like that yeah. into society is sort of one of the histories of the world. I mean, yeah. Homer's writing about it.
Yep.
Talking about it, you know.
Yep.
And of course, Shakespeare in the Elizabethan times would have been surrounded by people who had very intimate first-hand experiences and were yep. experiencing all sorts of
absolutely
traumatic, expressing their trauma in all yep. sorts of ways. Another way in which, you know, I'm always interested in, you know, reminding ourselves that people have not changed at all in 400 years at all.
I know.
We're, you know, aside from cell phones and
yeah.
the thing we're talking into right now, then otherwise, you
know, it's the same.
It would be the same. Yeah. I'd love to bring it back around to just hearing a little bit about your experiences in the Blackfriars, mm-hmm. because even though you're experienced in classical theater and in the elements of doubling and
yeah.
That we practice here, there is something about taking away some of the technical storytelling that I found as a director enormously challenging. I mean,
yeah.
and terrifying,
yeah.
actually. Like, when you tell me suddenly, like, you can't, there is no like you.
Yeah.
You think, what do you mean? How am
yeah.
I going to do the shadow effect for the end of Twelfth Night?
Right,
you
know? Right.
What's that like? What's that been like for you with the Caesar and Cleopatra?
Well, it's interesting you say it, because I've done so much theater with the lights on or with mm-hmm. very little.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I always will prefer an actor making a sound over a canned sound.
Right.
I try to get as much of that as possible. And yet what's funny is when you come into a place where it's, well, there's going to be no electronic sound and there's no light cues, it just takes the net away. There's something about, oh, I'm going to do this, but there's still a net there. It's like,
right.
well, like that, we can't do that, so let's have this piece of music come in.
Right.
And suddenly when the net's pulled out from under you, that's a different feeling. It is scary.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that I get nothing in transitions. I get nothing, you know. But it's great because it's like anything. I think, you know, when you have less resources or fewer resources, you have to depend on your imagination and the imagination of the audience and your actors, and you get more creative and more inventive and maybe more theatrical, because, you know, I love movies. I'm sure you do too. Like, I love
Absolutely.
Movies. And so I tend to sort of think more cinematically, and that then influences my directing on the stage, and then it sort of all gets mixed up. But man, when you have nothing, when it's a bare stage and the lights are up the entire time, and you really have to put your money where your mouth is and say, okay, I love theater because it's just actors in a room with an audience and nothing else, and that's all I need, and that's all you have, there's something kind of great about it too, because you just have to get really creative.
Is there something actually that's oddly more cinematic about it, because you can wipe the screen so fast and
yeah.
change location?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I've been learning, is having been a director whose work was called cinematic on
yep.
the stage, I'm finding I am increasingly more cinematic because there's less on the screen, and so you can change it at will, and that's
totally.
Why that's what Shakespeare could do that was so exciting.
Yeah. And
you
an
know?
Audience will follow it. We think they, oh, are they going to get that if we don't? Yes, I think they can. Their minds can leap as fast as
Yeah, I mean, you have this moment at the, or very early in Caesar and Cleopatra, and it's sort of the famous moment in the play where Caesar shows up at the foot
right.
of the Sphinx,
yeah.
And also, clearly, the first thing you read as a director and go... I mean, what I think about is you have the Midsummer moment where you go, like, how can you bring in a sphinx? You can never bring in a sphinx to the Great Chamber. What are you going to do? And if I might describe your solution, it is to have the actress who will be playing Cleopatra, who has not yet been identified as such, center stage, posing in sort of an up dog kind of sphinx-like, yoga-like pose. Yeah. And the actor playing Caesar above her in the balcony, talking to it. And it is so immediately an inducing of place. And then you become so fascinatingly engaged by the description that Shaw embeds into what Caesar says, which is incredibly poetic. Yeah, and he's having this confessional kind of moment alone with his own sense of greatness and ennui and advancing age, and it really sets up the whole play, and it is the simplest thing on earth, and it's so beautiful.
I think that it comes down to what do you absolutely need to just tell that story, and you can use as why have any more than that, you know? And it became that. We tried, it was a thing with the whole cast, you know, doing different poses and things like that, and soon just became what it is. And I, you're right. It in a way, that is as cinematic as anything else that in the production, and so simple and theatrical in that way. I think there's something about when you have very little at your disposal in terms of furniture and production value and even just deck hands to move things in and out or whatever, the locations become less important than just step by step putting the story together in a way that, I mean, it's hard when we, you know, you look at a script and you say, well, I've got to be in this drawing room, and then they're in this courtroom, or then they're moving out to the beach, or then they're, you know, and it's like, how do I go from that to that to that? And does the audience not only need to track that, but also, well, this was 10 a.m. in the morning, and now it's noon, and then it's tomorrow now. And and for me, even just putting Sense and Sensibility together was that. It was like every page is a new